this surrealist device, which I'd never used before, of taking a book, and it had to be a favorite book. So I took Joyce and opened it at random, and without looking at it, put my finger on the page, and where my finger rested, it said,
"Broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC Los Altos Hills."
And I thought, of course.
Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this segment we're going to be taking a look at some aspects of the O.J. Simpson case that have not received a whole lot of attention. As I speak on the evening, and this is being recorded, by the way, on February 16th of 1997, everyone is wound like a clock saying that O.J. was guilty and this, that, and the other thing. I have talked about the O.J. Simpson case at considerable length, and leaving aside the massive problems there are with not only evidence but testimony, and leaving aside the exculpatory evidence which was never presented, leaving aside the witnesses who could have cleared O.J. Simpson but who were threatened with death if they came forward, and above all, leaving aside the monstrously distorted media coverage of the O.J. Simpson case, which has led the vast majority of Americans to conclude incorrectly that O.J. Simpson was guilty. Most Americans do not know, for example, that the grand jury refused to indict O.J. Simpson, that the judge in the civil case would not let O.J. Simpson try on the gloves, and that, in fact, there is not only a mountain of evidence, but that there are serious, serious problems with virtually every piece of physical evidence in this case. Much of it obviously manufactured, and beyond that, the prosecution witnesses and witnesses for the plaintiffs almost all changed their testimony and changed them fundamentally with regard to both the criminal and civil cases. The media, however, have not reported this, and so as a result, the public has a very distorted view of what happened. It is my opinion that this may very well be a domestic intelligence operation, a type of operation known as a PSYOP, which has been launched by the Nazi faction of our intelligence community. And in fact, there is a Nazi faction of our intelligence community, and in my opinion, it is dominant at this stage of the game. I can also appreciate to the uninitiated listener, and that's not meant to be condescending or patronizing in any way, what I have just said will appear to be utter madness, and that is altogether comprehensible, given the distorted nature of the media coverage. What I'm going to be talking about in the next two segments are not only some aspects of Mark Furman's background and behavior that have escaped public attention to a large extent, but also some background concerning the place where Mark Furman moved to, a tiny little town in Idaho called Sand Point, which has become an epicenter of the white supremacist movement at this point. And there are serious questions about the possibility of Mark Furman himself having been involved with white supremacist groups, including possibly white supremacist groups within the LAPD. Some of the material that I'm about to relate will be by way of review for the veteran and dedicated listeners. We're going to begin by taking a look at some information from a book called Legacy of Deception, subtitled An Investigation of Mark Furman and Racism in the LAPD. The book was authored by Stephen Singular, that's spelled just like Singular, S-I-N-G-U-L-A-R, and published in softcover by Dove Books, copyright 1995. The author, by the way, Stephen Singular, is described on the back flap as, in the back cover, I should say, in the following terms. Stephen Singular is a Denver-based journalist whose first book, Talk to Death, The Life and Murder of Alan Berg, became the basis for the 1989 Oliver Stone film Talk Radio. His previous books include the New York Times bestseller A Killing in the Family and Charmed to Death. And what we're going to begin with is a discussion of serious indications that Mark Furman may very well be a white supremacist or even a Nazi. This information surfaced during an internal affairs investigation of Mark Furman, and the information was brought to light by a couple of assistant DAs, and some of the allegations made by fellow officers and some of the disturbing indications concerning Furman's behavior were brought to the attention of Marcia Clark by fellow members of the district attorney's office. However, Citizen Clark chose not to pay attention to this information. Turning now to Legacy of Deception, we read, "The event surfaced after the Furman tapes were aired in public, when it was revealed that the LAPD had conducted an internal affairs investigation of the detective in February of 1995. According to the report that came out of this investigation, in August or September of 1994, two detectives, Walter Purdy, P-U-R-D-Y, and David Lampkin, L-A-M-B-K-I-N, were in the L.A. Criminal Courts building where they'd come to file a case. They saw Deputy District Attorney Lucian Coleman, C-O-L-E-M-A-N, whom they'd known for years in the hallway, along with another Deputy D.A., Julie Sergojian, S-E-R-G-O-J-I-A-N. Coleman approached Purdy and said, 'Hey, have you heard the latest thing the defense is trying to pull?' After telling Purdy that the Simpson defense team was alleging Furman had planted a bloody glove at the defendant's estate, Coleman laughed. Purdy looked at her very seriously and said, "I wouldn't put anything past him," unquote. Coleman was taken aback by his response because she'd regarded the allegation as a joke. During the same conversation, the report states, Purdy told Sergosian and Coleman about an incident that occurred in 1987 while he was assigned to the WLA, or West Los Angeles, station. Coleman understood that Purdy married a Jewish woman. Coleman understood that Purdy married a Jewish woman. When Purdy came back from his honeymoon, he found numerous swastika insignias painted on the inside of his locker at the West L.A. station. Purdy told him that Furman's fingerprints were found on the inside of his locker. Sergosian was walking through the hallway when Coleman told her to stop and listen to something. Purdy stated that the matter had been investigated with fingerprints and photographs taken. Furman was determined to be responsible based on his fingerprints being found inside the locker. Furman received either a reprimand or some days off, unquote. While they were talking, Coleman also heard Purdy call Furman a Nazi, unquote. And still more about allegations by fellow officers that Furman may have white supremacist and even Nazi inclinations. When Deputy District Attorney Julie Sergosian was interviewed during the investigation, she confirmed what Coleman had told the investigators about Purdy's remarks in the criminal courts building in August or September of 1994. Sergosian, the report says, questioned Purdy about the matter of his locker. Purdy stated that the matter had been investigated with fingerprints and photographs taken. Furman was found responsible for the incident based on his fingerprints being found inside the locker. Purdy continued, stating Furman was very interested in Nazi memorabilia and had a Nazi uniform. Furman supposedly belonged to some type of Nazi collector's club. Unquote. In addition, information surfaced during this same investigation of Furman, which indicated that he may have known Nicole Brown Simpson, or certainly was boasting of having seen her breast enhancement surgery, quote, up close and personal. Returning to Legacy of Deception, we read, the detective, the report says, heard the story from someone who had been at a party with Furman. Furman had bragged he had seen Nicole Simpson's, quote, boob job, unquote. The party was some kind of non-LAPD event and was not a barbecue. Burke concluded from the detective's remarks that Nicole Simpson and Furman had been lovers. Coleman heard the same story from another detective from 77th Division. Sergosian learned of the story in October or November of 1994. Sergosian walked into the adjacent office where Deputy District Attorney Ellen Burke worked. Burke related another story about an officer who had spoken with Furman at a barbecue some years back. The officer had been at a barbecue for West L.A. officers with Furman. Furman stated that he had seen Nicole Brown Simpson's new, quote, boob job, unquote. Furman indicated that he saw the breast augmentation, quote, up close and personal, unquote. These allegations would tend to be supported by an odd piece of information that surfaced during the course of Mark Furman's testimony in the preliminary hearings for the O.J. Simpson trial. And while there's never been any confirmation of any kind of relationship, sexual or otherwise, that is, objective confirmation that surfaced in the media, at the same time, there were reports, as Stephen Singular discusses in his book Legacy of Deception, and as we talked about in an interview with Stephen Singular available from Spitfire, a tape duplication service that I'll tell you about later, there were numerous officers within the LAPD who had heard these same stories, and apparently Furman had made these sorts of statements, correct or incorrect, to numerous officers. There were even accounts that Mark Furman was Nicole's, quote, personal cop, unquote, on the LAPD. Whatever the substance of those allegations, it should be noted that Mark Furman appeared to have an uncommon knowledge of the custody status of O.J. and Nicole's children. And Stephen Singular writes in Legacy of Deception, as I studied the documents Douglas, that's Carl Douglas, a member of O.J.'s defense team in the criminal trial, as I studied the documents Douglas had sent, three things leaped out at me. All were in Furman's testimony. The first was on page 68, where he told the court about something that had passed through his mind in the immediate aftermath of the murders. I would be concerned with the younger Simpson children and the ex-husband, since they, Nicole and O.J., still had joint custody of the children, unquote. How, I asked myself, did he know about this joint custody arrangement? Was it common knowledge at the West Los Angeles Police Department? Or had he been told that by Nicole herself? No one on the defense team had asked him these questions. That is indeed interesting, and may have something to do with the allegations coming from fellow officers that Furman and Nicole knew each other quite well, perhaps even intimately. One of the things that blocked further investigation of some of the allegations concerning Mark Furman's white supremacist connections was the fact that Judge Lance Ito, himself married to Peggy York, the highest-ranking female member of the LAPD at that time and Furman's former watch commander, would not permit LAPD personnel records to be entered into evidence. It should be noted that allegations concerning Nazi inclinations on the part of Mark Furman also surfaced during the course of his military career. He was reported to have painted swastikas on the lockers of black Marines as well. However, Judge Ito, again married to Mark Furman's former watch commander, would not permit any of this information to be introduced into the criminal trial. Turning now to Newsweek magazine of March 6th of 1995, we read an article in the Society section entitled Furman in the Crosshairs, subtitled O.J., the Controversial Cop Faces New Charges. And skipping down, we read, in another incident Newsweek has learned, an African-American policewoman gave sworn testimony that portrayed Furman as a racist and a sexist. As part of an administrative board hearing in 1984 and 1985, Tia Morris, now a detective who outranks Furman, testified that Furman told her she, quote, didn't belong, unquote, on the force. He suggested that she become a secretary or a dancer on Soul Train. And the following is perhaps even more significant. At the hearing, Morris identified Furman as the unofficial leader of a notorious cop clique called Men Against Women and the ringleader for another less well-known group that went by the acronym WASP, for White Anglo-Saxon Policemen. We should note that the LAPD and L.A. County Sheriff's Department do have a history of penetration by white supremacist groups. There was, in 1991, a fairly well-known, at least in the L.A. area, incident concerning the Vikings, basically a white supremacist group within the L.A. County Sheriff's Department. We should also note that Dennis Mahone, a prominent white supremacist leader and former Ku Klux Klan leader with connections running over to Europe, had also been recruiting from within the Los Angeles Police Department. We should also note that Mark Furman, as we will discuss later on in this segment and in the next segment, after his retirement from LAPD and even before the trial, the criminal trial was over, had moved up to Sandpoint, Idaho, a tiny little town with a population of about 5,200, which has become one of the epicenters of the white supremacist movement in the United States. An interesting piece of information also surfaced during the course of the airing of the Laura Hart McKinney tapes, which also, by the way, were entitled Men Against Women, which was the head of this misogynist clique within LAPD, which was the name, I should say, of this misogynist clique within LAPD that Furman, according to a fellow detective, was the head of. We're going to turn now to a book called Blood Oath, subtitled The Conspiracy to Murder Nicole Brown Simpson. This book was co-authored by Stephen Wirth and Carl Jaspers. I've dealt with this book at considerable length in the past. I've interviewed Stephen Wirth by himself and in conjunction with other authors, including Stephen Singular. The book is basically about an apparent or at least alleged white supremacist conspiracy to murder Nicole, frame O.J. Simpson, and the back cover of the book reads as follows. Blood Oath is the story of an ongoing conspiracy that began with the attempted AME church bombing in Los Angeles and the targeting of prominent African Americans for assassination by an elite strike team of white supremacists. The motive? To divide Americans and incite a race war. The battlefield? The American judicial system. The timing? The 10th anniversary of the assassination of liberal talk show host Alan Berg in Denver, June of 1984, their last big success. By the way, I would note that Stephen Singular, who authored the book Talk to Death about the murder of Alan Berg, was contacted by a source within the Los Angeles legal system because of his work on the murder of Alan Berg and told that basically white supremacists and neo-Nazis were not on the fringes of society anymore but had entered into the system and were doing a great deal of damage. Hence Stephen Singular's involvement in the case. Continuing with the back cover of Blood Oath, the action, the execution of Nicole Brown Simpson, a white woman married to a prominent black hero, the informant, codenamed Skinner, and the plot between the covers of Blood Oath, the conspiracy to murder Nicole Brown Simpson, again published in softcover by Rainbow Books and copyrighted 1996. The informant Skinner, who maintains he was actually a part of the elite white supremacist strike team that liquidated Nicole and Ron and framed O.J. Simpson, also maintains that the Oklahoma City bombing was pulled off by this same group and that this same group, basically that guilt over the Oklahoma City bombing and also the loss of some of his white supremacist comrades in that bombing led him to come forward with the information. In Blood Oath, the authors present an interesting statement by Mark Furman in the course of the Laura Hart McKinney tapes. And turning to page 258 in Blood Oath, we read, in addition to impeaching the preceding testimony of Detective Furman, Professor McKinney's tapes reveal an individual with a racist attitude scornful of the LAPD, who has a thought process very similar to that of the kinsmen of the cause. Detective Furman's remarks include, quote, black members of the city council should be lined up against a wall and effing shot, unquote, and, quote, the NAACP and the civil liberties union groups that support many black causes should be bombed, unquote. When referring to the next part is particularly interesting. When referring to the KKK, he says, quote, I'm the Grand Dragon, the Hood, unquote. Again, when referring to the KKK, he says, quote, I'm the Grand Dragon, the Hood, unquote. It remains to be determined exactly what he meant by that, but in light of some of the indications of white supremacist activity on his part and the charges by a fellow detective who now outranks Furman, well, Furman doesn't rank at all, he's retired from the force, that he was the de facto ringleader of a white supremacist group called WASP, white Anglo-Saxon policemen, the statement that, quote, I'm the Grand Dragon, the Hood, unquote, I think warrants closer scrutiny than it has received to date, or, in my opinion, is ever likely to receive. One of the things that's interesting about Blood Oath is that it contains information which was presented to the authors by this anonymous informant codenamed Skinner, who maintains he was part of the team that actually dispatched Ron and Nicole and framed OJ, and that information later turned out to be corroborated from other sources. One of the pieces of information that Skinner provided to the authors is discussed on page 65, and it concerns allegations by Skinner that members of the LAPD or LA law enforcement had warned O.J. Simpson that his life was in danger, and that some of the detectives who had warned O.J. were sympathetic to the white supremacist cause, with indications of white supremacist activity within the ranks of L.A. law enforcement, quite probably involving Mark Furman in some capacity. This is interesting and quite possibly significant. It grows in significance with information that will be presented later in this and the next segment. Skinner, in a discussion with, or Skinner relates discussion among the various members of the white supremacist group that, according to Skinner, liquidated Nicole and Ron. By the way, that group is called CAUSE, an acronym for Christian Aryan Underground Special Enforcers. And in Blood Oath, we read, now get this, one of the members talking to another in a planning session, now get this, some of our sympathetic LAPD detectives have warned O.J. Simpson that his life is in danger. One more time. Now get this. Some of our sympathetic LAPD detectives have warned O.J. Simpson that his life is in danger. This is interesting because this information was provided to the authors, Stephen Wirth and Carl Jaspers, before information which corroborates what Skinner just said came out in a book by Mark Elliott, who authored a book about Cato Kalin. And it turns out that indeed O.J. Simpson had been getting death threats from white supremacist groups, that acquaintances on LAPD, it does not say sympathetic to the white supremacist cause, but that acquaintances in L.A. law enforcement had warned him and that the FBI knew about this. Turning to page 278 in Blood Oath, there is an excerpting of the book The Whole Truth by Mark Elliott about Cato Kalin, specifically on pages 244 and 245 of that book. We read, quoting from Blood Oath, which in turn quotes from The Whole Truth by Mark Elliott about Cato, quote, O.J. told Cato he was worried about what he referred to only as, quote, some KKK group, unquote. He believed they, quote unquote, were out to get him. Several times during the months Cato lived at his house, he told him about a group he knew of that hated blacks and Jews, and because he was black and an active fundraiser for several Jewish charitable organizations, he was a top target on their hit list. He was convinced his life was in danger and that, quote, they, unquote, wouldn't rest until he was dead. He told Cato he had heard about this from several of his detective friends and that the FBI had also been in contact to warn him. As a result, he said, he was constantly in fear of being hit. He said he told Nicole about it, but that she didn't believe him, unquote. And according to Stephen Wirth, this information came out after Skinner had told him about the warnings provided to O.J. Simpson by LAPD people or L.A. law enforcement people who knew him and were sympathetic to the white supremacist cause. Apparently, Nicole also had been receiving death threats from white supremacist groups. We're going to turn now to a book called Killing Time, subtitled Who Murdered Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman, the First Full Investigation. The book was co-authored by longtime intelligence community researcher Donald Freed, F-R-E-E-D, and Raymond Briggs, and it was published in hardcover by the Macmillan Press and copyrighted 1996. And turning to page 148 in the book, we read the following concerning threats delivered to O.J. and Nicole by white supremacist groups. Both O.J. and Nicole tell Cato Kalin they had neo-Nazi threats by telephone and letter 1993 and 94. The terrorists target their interracial union and their ties to Jews. It should also be noted right below that, O.J. tells a friend he found his kitchen door open late at night, June 11, 1994, the night before the murders. Inside, he finds a strange message on his answering machine, which seems to be in a foreign language. One of the things that Skinner told Stephen Wirth and Carl Jaspers was that a foreign terrorist group that had been conducting a race war in their own part of the world, which was causing problems with the U.S. and its allies, had helped to finance Operation Thunderbolt, the killing of Nicole and Ron, and the framing of O.J. Simpson. It's not made clear what that foreign terrorist group is, but from the context, it seems quite probable that that was a German Nazi group, quite possibly connected with some of the old guard from the Third Reich. I call that old guard the Underground Reich. We should note, too, that apparently, and one of the pieces of information that Skinner provided to Carl Jaspers and Stephen Wirth was that the Cause strike team had Nicole's and OJ's places electronically and physically surveilled, that both the intercoms and telephones of Nicole and OJ had been tapped. They had OJ and Nicole under physical surveillance and also electronic surveillance involving the most sophisticated equipment, including infrared night vision equipment. This is interesting because Nicole apparently felt that she was being observed by someone, and she asked O.J. and his friends to come by because she felt she was threatened. Turning to page 146 of Killing Time, we read, "Someone other than O.J. Simpson was focused on her, Nicole knew, because she reported to friends that she had seen people near her residence, and when she was driving, people who seemed suspicious and made her anxious. There were also telephone calls that were obscene, both sexually and racially. Calls that were so disturbing that she asked Simpson and several friends to drive by her condominium when they were in her neighborhood in the evening hours just to keep an eye on her and the children. This harassment helps explain information that came into the trial regarding Simpson's having been seen at night near her Gretna Green residence where she lived before moving to Bundy in 1994. Indeed, it does, I think, present a rather interesting take on O.J.'s presence around Nicole's place. What is significant about the allegations of white supremacist activity on the part of Mark Furman, that he was head of basically a white supremacist group within LAPD, the fact that O.J. Simpson and Nicole were getting written and telephone death threats from white supremacist groups, and according to Skinner and according to information provided to Cato Kalin and accessed by Mark Elliott, members of L.A. law enforcement had warned O.J. that his life was in danger from white supremacist groups. According to Skinner, some of these warnings came from members of L.A. law enforcement who were sympathetic to the cause. By the way, I want to refresh for veteran listeners' purposes the information presented in a long series done in the spring of 1996 entitled Specialized Knowledge and Abilities. This refers to the tactic of Nazi elements and fascist elements worldwide of infiltrating the police and the military with the purpose of not only compromising and ultimately discrediting and turning those institutions, but also the purpose of acquiring, quote, specialized knowledge and abilities, unquote, to be eventually used to overthrow the democratic state. One of the things that's interesting about the apparent white supremacist activity on the part of Mark Furman, the fact that Lance Ito would not permit this into the trial, perhaps blocked a further investigation of this situation, and also the allegations that Mark Furman had some sort of personal relationship with Nicole, perhaps even a sexual relationship, is that when Mark Furman testified in the criminal trial, he didn't just perjure himself about the use of the N-word, but he also perjured himself about where he was and what he was doing the night of the killings. It is even possible that Marcia Clark was aware of this, although that has not been determined. Turning once again to the book Blood Oath by Stephen Wirth and Carl Jaspers, softcover Rainbow Books, copyright 1996, of the discrepancies between what Mark Furman said he was doing in court on said he was doing on the night of June 12, 1994, and what he was actually doing, we read the following. Mark Furman claims to have attended a Police Protective League meeting as an official delegate that extended over Saturday, June 11th and Sunday, June 12, 1994. The location being the La Quinta Resort in La Quinta, California, approximately 110 miles east of Los Angeles. La Quinta is capital L-A, capital Q-U-I-N-T-A. Saturday's schedule involved a general meeting from 8 o'clock. By the way, that was my interjection. Saturday's schedule involved a general meeting from 8 a.m. to 3 in the afternoon. In the evening, there was a reception starting at 7 p.m. at the tennis club and a barbecue dinner scheduled from 8 p.m. until 9:30 p.m. Sunday's agenda called for a general session meeting to be held from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m., after which the league members checked out. Mark Furman gives possible perjured testimony on March 9, 1995, as he testified on the witness stand. Source, trial, March 9, 1995. Witness, Detective Mark Furman. Direct examination by Marcia Clark. And what follows is an actual excerpting of the Furman testimony in the criminal trial. On the evening of June 12, 1994, at approximately 8 p.m., oh, this is Marcia Clark's question, by the way. Question. On the evening of June 12, 1994, at approximately 8 p.m., where were you? Answer. At approximately 8 p.m., I was in east of Palm Desert in La Quinta Resort at a Protective League seminar. Question. Was that a police officer's function, sir? Answer. Yes, I'm a delegate in the Protective League, or was at that time. Question. Okay, and at what time did you leave? Answer. I believe I left somewhere around 8 o'clock, just as the barbecue was starting. Question. And you left. When you left, you drove where? Answer. I drove to my home. Question. Remember what time you got home, sir? Answer. About 10:30. Question. And was there anyone home when you got there? Answer. My wife. Question. What time did you go to bed? Answer. I believe about 11 o'clock, maybe a little later. Mark Furman couldn't have left La Quinta on Sunday, June 12, 1994, because the barbecue was on Saturday. There was no barbecue on Sunday. Why did he use it as an alibi for his whereabouts, and why did Marcia Clark ask him where he was at 8 p.m.? Attorneys are taught never to ask a question unless you know the answer. Had she checked it out? Was she attempting to validate his alibi? A more potentially incriminating situation arises if Mark Furman's answer was based on his possible departure on Saturday the 11th, prior to the barbecue. Does it make sense for him to attend a session that ended at 3 p.m., hang around for 4 hours until drinks were served at 7 p.m., and then drive back to his home in Redondo Beach? On Saturday, June 12th, there was a general session meeting scheduled from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. Since contract negotiations were taking place, one could assume that the delegates were meeting to discuss the acceptance or rejection of the city's latest wage offer that was a result of long, difficult negotiations. As a delegate, he was planning on leaving his house at 5:30 a.m. to drive back for that session. Or did he have more important business back in Los Angeles? Remember, Skinner claimed that the deliverer, he was the contact point for the strike team, was meeting with the Dark German on the day of the murders, June 12th. The Dark German, which coincidentally or otherwise rhymes with Mark Furman, is the code name that was given by Skinner and the authors to the insider that the Cause Group had within L.A. law enforcement, and there may have been more than one insider. We're going to continue with an analysis of Mark Furman, his possible white supremacist connections, and extend outward to other activity of that type being conducted around the country. That's all we have time for in this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening. Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this segment we're going to continue with our examination of not only some of Mark Furman's possible white supremacist connections, but also we're going to take a look at some of the white supremacist activity involving people in and around Sandpoint, Idaho, the tiny town to which Mark Furman retired, and which has become something of an epicenter of the white supremacist movement in the United States. We're also going to take a look at Nazi activities abroad that bear a resemblance to what may very well have happened with the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron, and the framing of O.J. Simpson. In the previous segment, we took a look, first of all, at information from an internal affairs investigation of Mark Furman that he may very well have been a neo-Nazi or had white supremacist leanings, although an apparent cover-up and a circling of the wagon, so to speak, by LAPD followed that investigation. Fellow detectives and district attorneys made charges that Furman was basically a Nazi, and apparently an internal affairs investigation found Furman responsible for painting swastikas on a fellow detective's locker after he married a Jewish woman. In addition to allegations, quite substantive ones, of Mark Furman's white supremacist activity, we also took a look at allegations based on things Furman had apparently told fellow officers, that there was a relationship of some kind, perhaps even an intimate sexual relationship between Mark Furman and Nicole Brown Simpson. There were numerous reports that that Furman was, quote, Nicole's personal cop, unquote, on the LAPD. I would also note that Furman, according to fellow officers, had bragged, rightly or wrongly, about having viewed Nicole's breast enhancement surgery, quote, up close and personal. One of the things that's interesting is that in his pretrial testimony, Mark Furman betrayed unusual knowledge of the custody status of Nicole and OJ's children, although not conclusive. That would tend to indicate that his interest in Nicole Brown Simpson was more than just professional. He certainly had a large awareness of OJ and Nicole's children's custody status. We will, in future broadcasts, be discussing some of the curious activity of various L.A. law enforcement members around the domestic abuse incidents that took place between O.J. and Nicole. There are no written reports of most of those incidents, and beyond that, a number of the policemen involved, including Mark Furman, were members of the LAPD 44, cited by the Christopher Commission as having a history of abuse towards minorities. In addition to information indicating that Furman may very well have been or still is a white supremacist or Nazi, and the distinct possibility that he had a relationship, perhaps even a personal, an intimate sexual relationship with Nicole, we also took a look at information from an internal investigation that was conducted in 1984 and 85. These allegations made by a fellow detective, a female detective, that Furman was the de facto head of a misogynist clique within LAPD called Men Against Women, and also the head of a less well-known clique called WASP, standing for White Anglo-Saxon Policemen. We should note that Judge Ito would not permit this information to be introduced into the criminal trial. What's interesting about that is that Ito was married to Furman's former watch commander, Peggy York. Ito submitted an affidavit claiming that he did not have a conflict of interest because they did not know each other, which is interesting because in the Laura Hart McKinney tapes, Mark Furman goes on at some length about how much he despised Peggy York. In fact, that even brought tears to Lance Ito's eyes. That part got a lot of publicity. The statements by fellow detective, or fellow at the time, Detective Tia Morris, that Furman was head of a group called WASP, but did not receive much publicity. We also took a look at an excerpt from the Laura Hart McKinney tapes in which Furman brags in referencing the Ku Klux Klan that, quote, I'm the Grand Dragon, the Hood, which could conceivably refer to his head of his heading up that group WASP, as Tia Morris maintained. We also took a look at information presented by Skinner, the anonymous informant who informed Carl Wirth and Carl Jaspers, the co-authors of Blood Oath, that O.J. Simpson had been warned by LAPD law enforcement, or by L.A. law enforcement personnel sympathetic to the white supremacist cause, that his life was in danger from white supremacist groups. Later on, that information was corroborated in a book by Mark Elliott about Cato Kalin, and information was presented in that book, which not only corroborated what Skinner told O.J., but which maintained that the FBI knew of these threats to O.J. Simpson, and again, he had apparently been warned by acquaintances on the in L.A. law enforcement, according to Skinner, some of those sympathetic to the white supremacist cause. We also took a look at information from the book Killing Time by Donald Freed and Raymond Briggs that Nicole, as well, had been getting written and telephone death threats from white supremacist groups, and also that she was apparently being surveilled by someone who made her feel very uncomfortable, that she was getting obscene phone calls that were very explicit, both racially and sexually, and that she asked O.J. and his friends to come around because she feared for her life. This corroborates information, or it jibes with information presented by Skinner to Carl Jaspers and Stephen Wirth, that the elite white supremacist cause strike team had O.J. and Nicole under a very sophisticated electronic and physical surveillance. One of the most interesting things that we looked at in our first segment was the fact that Mark Furman may very well have given a perjured testimony in his criminal trial. He certainly perjured himself about using the N-word, and interestingly enough, when Marsha Clark asked Mark Furman where he was, what he was doing the night of June 12th, he claimed that he was at a Police Protective League barbecue, which in point of fact occurred the previous evening. The barbecue was at 8 o'clock on Saturday, June 11th, not on Sunday, June 12th, as Mark Furman claimed. Whatever else one could say about Mark Furman, he is not a stupid man. He's a highly intelligent individual. One wonders whether his memory could have been so casually mistaken. Would also note that he pleaded guilty to perjury, got something like a $200 fine and probation. I would also note that in the opinion of some lawyers I've spoken to, the allegations concerning Mark Furman's white supremacist connections and concerning his apparent knowledge of Nicole, possibly intimate knowledge of Nicole, the fact that according to fellow officers he had white supremacist and neo-Nazi inclinations, may very well have been head of a white supremacist group within LAPD, that OJ and Nicole were getting telephoned and written death threats from white supremacist groups, including, according to Skinner, some warnings presented to OJ by members of LA law enforcement, this known to the FBI, taken in conjunction with Furman's possibly perjured testimony concerning his whereabouts on the night of June 12th, 1994, might, and note the use of the term might, have been enough for a grand jury to indict Mark Furman for murder. Not that this would have been enough for a criminal jury to convict, don't get me wrong there, or not that a grand jury is going to, but in the opinion of two lawyers I've spoken to, those facts taken in conjunction with one another might have been enough for a grand jury to indict Furman for murder. Don't bet on that happening, folks. That ain't going to happen, not by a long shot. However, it's worth noting for purposes of history. I also want to note that Mark Furman, as we have discussed in previous programs concerning the O.J. Simpson case, after his retirement from LAPD during the criminal trial, moved to Sandpoint, Idaho, a tiny town of 5,200 in Idaho, which has become something of an epicenter for the white supremacist movement. We're going to turn again to the book Blood Oath, co-authored by Stephen Wirth and Carl Jaspers, subtitled The Conspiracy to Murder Nicole Brown Simpson. The book was published in softcover by Rainbow Books, copyright 1996, and it is summed up on the back as follows. Blood Oath is the story of an ongoing conspiracy that began with the attempted AME church bombing in Los Angeles and the targeting of prominent African Americans for assassination by an elite strike team of white supremacists. The motive? To divide Americans and incite a race war. The battlefield, the American judicial system. The timing, the 10th anniversary of the assassination of liberal talk show host Alan Berg in Denver, June of 1984, their last big success. The action, the execution of Nicole Brown Simpson, a white woman married to a prominent black hero. The informant, codenamed Skinner. And I would also note that information was presented to Stephen Wirth and Carl Jaspers that this operation was financed by a foreign terrorist group that was had caused problems with the U.S. and its allies by waging a race war in their own part of the world. It's not conclusive who that might have been, but one of the distinct possibilities is that it might have been a German Nazi group. And I would also note that Skinner maintains that the Oklahoma City bombing was pulled off by this same group, which had infiltrated the Patriots and militia movements. We're going to turn now to the book Blood Oath, again by Stephen Wirth and Carl Jaspers, and we're going to take a look at not only Mark Furman's retirement to Sandpoint, but some of the other people who were retiring to Sandpoint and in Sandpoint at around the same time. Turning to page 290 of Blood Oath, we read, "A series of coincidences involve Sandpoint, Idaho, and one Lewis Beam, B-E-A-M. Sandpoint appears to have developed a magnetic appeal, attracting individuals our nation as a whole has been more than willing to give up. Was it pure coincidence that Lewis Beam, a fantastically effective organizer for the Aryan Nations, retired here about the same time as Mark Furman? Lewis Beam, a friend of Richard Butler, the founder of the Aryan Nations, was a charter member of its splinter group, The Order, founded in 1983 after Butler called for a racial holy war. The Order was responsible for the murder of Denver radio talk show host Alan Berg a year later. Klan Watch credits Beam with the group's recent comeback through the use of such rhetoric as, 'Get ready for what we know is coming. Everyone talks of a race war. How many guns, bullets, food, training, preparations have you made? Our forefathers built this country with courage and blood. It will take fresh blood, but by God, a lot of it will be the blood of our enemies. Get ready,' unquote." Here is what several recent editions of the Klan Watch intelligence report had to say about Mr. Beam. From the October 1995 edition, Louis Beam created an assassination point system in 1983 that was used to reward Aryan Nation's warriors who kill enforcement officers, federal officials, civil rights leaders, and other, quote, enemies, unquote. The order adopted Beam's point system to motivate its members, unquote. I would also note that we've noted in past broadcasts, utilizing, among other things, information from the British Searchlight, an anti-fascist publication, that Louis Beam and the other Aryan Nations affiliated personnel have considerable land holdings in Sandpoint. There is an Identity Christian congregation in Sandpoint, Idaho. Identity Christianity is the racist and anti-Semitic perversion of Christianity that the Aryan Nations subscribe to, and that in fact there is an Identity Christian congregation in Sandpoint, Idaho. Bear in mind that there are only 5,200 people in that entire town. It's an interesting place for Mark Furman to have retired to at that time. And apparently, white supremacists have been staging something of an exodus in the direction of Sandpoint, which is rapidly becoming an epicenter of the white supremacist movement. Research credit on the following article goes to a member of the listening audience who researched this from the Village Voices issue of November 26, 1996. On page 26, there's an article entitled Robbing and Squealing, subtitled The Far Right with a New Structure Finances Itself the Same Old Violent Way. It's authored by James Ridgway. And skipping down in the article, we read concerning a series of bank robberies allegedly performed by a white supremacist offshoot of the Aryan Nations entitled the Aryan Republican Army. We read, talking of some of the members of that army, of the group that allegedly performed the robberies, both Steteford and McCarthy are acquaintances of Aryan Nations Pennsylvania leader Mark Thomas. According to friends, Guthrie lived with Thomas for a time. A former Aryan Nations official said Guthrie visited the Aryan Nations headquarters at Hayden Lake, Idaho in 1991. In addition, Thomas, Steteford, and McCarthy had all visited Elohim City. Elohim City in Oklahoma is a white supremacist compound that was contacted by Timothy McVeigh and others associated with the investigation into the Oklahoma City bombing. Bear in mind Skinner's allegation that the same group that killed Nicole and Ron and framed OJ also pulled off the Oklahoma City situation. And in the aforementioned, actually the series that I alluded to in the previous half-hour segment, Specialized Knowledge and Abilities, we discuss Elohim City and a previous alleged attempt to blow up the Oklahoma City building and some of the many evidentiary tributaries running between Elohim City, the Aryan Nations, the Oklahoma City investigation, and the alleged previous plot. Continuing. Kevin McCarthy testified at Steteford's trial last week that there was a fifth member of the bank robbery gang. On the instructions of the U.S. attorney, he did not name him, but the Columbus Dispatch and the McCurtain Daily Gazette, a local Oklahoma paper, reported the man was Michael Brescia, B-R-E-S-C-I-A, a neo-Nazi living in the Philadelphia area. McCarthy testified that, after a robbery in Madison, Wisconsin, Steteford drove this fifth robber to Elohim City. There, Brescia roomed with Andreas Strassmeyer, the mysterious German linked to Timothy McVeigh shortly before the Oklahoma City bombing. McVeigh's phone records show a call to Elohim City, where residents say he was trying to get in touch with Strassmeyer. Both Strassmeyer, who acknowledges meeting McVeigh, and Brescia have been named as co-defendants in a civil suit filed by Oklahoma City bombing victim Edie Smith, whose two small children were killed in the blast. By the way, I've discussed Andreas Strassmeyer at some length in the past. In addition to being an acquaintance of McVeigh, he acknowledges knowing McVeigh, but denies that he was involved in any way in the Oklahoma City bombing, although he has also been reluctant to talk about some of those connections because, as he puts it, running your mouth can get you into trouble. Andreas Strassmeyer is the son of Gunter Strassmeyer, Helmut Kohl's former chief of staff. I've also noted that Andreas Strassmeyer was represented by Kirk Lyons, a white supremacist attorney, who had a legal support group for various white supremacists, which, coincidentally or not, was entitled Cause. That is the same title that Skinner alleges the white supremacist group that killed Nicole and Ron and framed OJ bore. Again, that an acronym for Christian Aryan Underground Special Enforcers. Continuing with this Village Voice article from 11/26/96. In his testimony, McCarthy described how Thomas provided him with false identification and pistols. Thomas was present at a meeting near Van Buren, Arkansas in November of 1994, where McCarthy met Langdon and Guthrie. A couple of other white supremacists, a fellow named Peter Langan, 38, and also a fellow named Richard Lee Guthrie. Continuing. The Midwest bank robberies form one strand of the white resistance. Another came to light recently following a series of arrests in Washington State. In a string of robberies reminiscent of the orders strikes more than a decade ago, on July 10th, a group of masked men set off a pipe bomb behind a bureau of the Spokane Spokesman Review. A few minutes later, they robbed and bombed the Spokane branch of the U.S. Bank. In a similar incident, a bomb was thrown into Spokane Valley's Planned Parenthood clinic on July 12th. Later that day, the same U.S. bank branch was robbed. The robbers left literature and symbols of the Phineas priesthood. By the way, that is a white supremacist group that cites alleged biblical preferences in order to justify their murder of people they consider to be enemies. Continuing. In early October, in the midst of an elaborate undercover operation, FBI agents arrested three men, Charles Barbee, capital B-A-R-B-E-E, 44, Robert S. Barr, 44, actually Robert S. Berry, B-E-R-R-Y, 42, and Vern J. Merrill, M-E-R-R-E-L-L, 51, all of Sand Point, Idaho. That's the town to which Louis Beam and Mark Furman had retired to. Population 5,200. Continuing. The three had participated in America's Promise, a Christian identity group frequented by Louis Beam, a former Ku Klux Klan Grand Dragon, longtime ambassador to the Aryan Nations, and widely considered to be the de facto leader of the far right. The government believes Merrill to be the leader of the gang. The son of an upper-middle-class Philadelphia family, he went into the submarine service in the Navy following high school. After serving in the Atlantic Fleet for 12 years, Merrill got jobs and security clearances in domestic nuclear power plants. Merrill was someone who converted his investments into gold and buried them in the countryside. According to the Spokesman Review, he got involved in the Arizona Patriot far-right paramilitary group with strong resemblance to the underground Posse Comitatus groups that proliferated in the West and Midwest in the 1970s and 1980s. In the late 1980s, some Arizona Patriots moved to the Sandpoint, Idaho area at the same time that America's Promise Ministries moved there from Phoenix. Sandpoint has become a focal point of the far right. It lies north of the Aryan Nation's headquarters. Both Beam and Merrill write for Jubilee, the Christian identity newspaper, whose editor also lives there. These robberies in both the West and Pacific Northwest clearly show how the white supremacist movement learned from its defeats a decade ago. In the 1980s, the order fell because its members ratted out on each other under pressure from the FBI. It remains to be seen whether the cell structure that replaced the order can profit in the face of a squeeze by the feds. I would note that Skinner maintained that the cause strike team that liquidated Nicole and Ron and framed O.J. was in fact part of a blind cell, and one of their members, codenamed the Deliverer, was the only person who knew who the leaders were and who some of the other members of this operation were, including people who had penetrated L.A. law enforcement, those codenamed the Dark German. I would also note that it may very well be that the penetration of institutions by these types of elements may very well have gone all the way up to and including the intelligence community. My suspicion for a long time has been that the killing of Nicole and Ron and the framing of O.J. was a domestic intelligence operation, a psyop, literally a Nazi psyop, by a Nazi faction of our national security establishment. Interestingly enough, these three men who have been charged in connection with the bombings and bank robberies in the Pacific Northwest are now being investigated in connection with the Olympics bombing as well, or the bombing at the Olympics in the summer of 1996. Reading now from the New York Times of Monday, January 27th of 1997, we read the following story by Kerry Goldberg, G-O-L-D-B-E-R-G, Dateline Seattle, January 26th, and headlined, "Investigators Check New Lead in Bombing at Olympic Park." The article reads in part as follows. A Washington State newspaper reported today that investigators looking into the fatal bombing at last summer's Olympic Games in Atlanta were interested in three men accused of politically motivated bombings and bank robberies in the Pacific Northwest. Skipping down, the three, Charles Barbee, 44, Robert S. Berry, 42, and Vern J. Merrill, 51, all of the Sandpoint, Idaho area, are charged with bombing an office of the Spokesman Review last April 1st and a Spokane Planned Parenthood clinic on July 12th. They are also accused of robbing Spokane banks on the same days, along with a fourth masked gunman who has yet to be caught. They are scheduled to stand trial on February 10th in Spokane. So again, whether or not those individuals were responsible for the Olympics bombing, it is interesting to note that the investigation, at least according to some sources, has now switched from the East Coast to the West Coast and is now focusing on people from Sandpoint, Idaho, population 5,200, including Mark Furman and Lewis Beam. More about Michael Brescia. He has now apparently been indicted in connection with the bank robberies that I alluded to in the that I read about in the Village Voice article. Following is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, January 31st of 1997. This is an AP story headlined, "White Supremacists Indicted in Robberies," subtitled, "Bank Heist Funds Allegedly Used for Racist Group," and it's dateline Philadelphia. One of the nation's leading white supremacists and four others were indicted on conspiracy charges yesterday in seven Midwestern bank robberies whose proceeds allegedly bankrolled their movement. Mark Thomas, leader of the Aryan Nations in Pennsylvania and a minister in the white supremacist Christian Identity Movement, recruited gang members at his home in Macungie, M-A-C-U-N-G-I-E, a small town near Allentown, the indictment said. Three others named yesterday were charged last year with robbing 22 banks of $250,000 over 2 years as members of the self-proclaimed Midwestern Bank Bandits, also known as the Aryan Republican Army. The gang's alleged ringleader, Peter Langan, L-A-N-G-A-N 38, is standing trial in Columbus, Ohio. The name of the fifth suspect, Michael W. Brescia, 24, has surfaced during the investigation into the Oklahoma City bombing. He once lived with a German citizen whom Timothy McVeigh tried to call 12 days before the bombing terrorist attack. That, by the way, the aforementioned German and son of Helmut Kohl's former chief of staff, Andreas Strassmeier, son of Gunter Strassmeier. Before moving on to some Nazi activities in Europe, reminiscent of some of the things we may be seeing in connection with the O.J. Simpson case, I want to note that three FBI agents have been placed on leave, have been suspended, and that two of these individuals had been given testimony or been involved in the investigations into the Oklahoma City bombing and also the O.J. Simpson case. Reading now from the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, January 29th of 1997, we read the following, a Washington Post story, dateline Washington, headlined, "Three FBI bomb probers removed from jobs," subtitled, "Crime Lab Procedures Under Scrutiny." A senior FBI official who helped supervise the crime scenes at the bombings of the Oklahoma City Federal Building and New York's World Trade Center was among those removed from his position after an unusual Justice Department report that criticizes the work of the Bureau's once-renowned laboratory. Skipping down, it was not clear whether the Inspector General report found problems with the Oklahoma City or World Trade Center investigations, but sources say the Justice Department is bracing for challenges because of the involvement of Williams, Thurman, and Martz, M-A-R-T-Z, that's Roger Martz, who also did lab work for the O.J. Simpson case. By the way, he did lab work on behalf of the defense in the criminal trial. And again, whether there's any significance to it or not, bear in mind what Skinner had to say about the O.J. Simpson framing and the killing of Nicole and Ron having been pulled off by the same people who pulled off Oklahoma City. Bear in mind also Skinner's charges that Operation Thunderbolt, the killing of Nicole and the framing of O.J., was financed by a foreign terrorist group, quite possibly a German Nazi group, that was conducting a race war in its own part of the world that was causing problems with the U.S. and its allies. In the aforementioned Specialized Knowledge and Abilities series, we took a look at operational connections between German and American Nazi elements, and we've taken a look in past broadcasts at operational connections between various white supremacist and Nazi and fascist groups around the world. Research credit on the following goes to Dave White, our pan-European researcher and translator, who gleaned the following from the London Daily Mail of Monday, January 20th of 1997. This is an article entitled, "Racial Bombers Target Stars," subtitled, "Nazi Group Threatens Famous Couples." It's by Stephen Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, and Nick Craven, C-R-A-V-E-N, and it reads in part as follows. British sports stars in mixed-race marriages were warned last night they could be targets in a neo-Nazi bombing campaign. Boxer Frank Bruno, swimmer-turned-TV celebrity Sharon Davies, and England footballer Paul Ince were alerted as a Danish cell with links to the British paramilitary group Combat 18 was seized after a Scotland Yard tip-off. Three powerful letter bombs destined for Britain, explosive devices hidden in video cassettes, were intercepted in an operation involving police across Europe. Danish Justice Minister Frank Jensen, J-E-N-S-E-N, who was understood to have been in close contact with the Yard, said the bombers' intended victims included, quote, sports people married to blacks, unquote, and known left-wingers. A Channel 4 journalist was also said to be on the terrorist list. And it goes on to describe some of the people who had been targeted by this Nazi group. One of them is a boxer, Frank Bruno, a British boxer, Frank Bruno, B-R-U-N-O, and his wife, Laura. And two others targeted by the group, according to the investigators, are a woman named Sharon Davies and her husband, who's named Derek Raymond, and also a football player named Paul Ince, I-N-C-E, and his wife, Claire. All three of them, Frank Bruno, Derek Sharon Davies, and Paul Ince, are all black males married to pretty, blonde, white women. And I want to ask members of the listening audience to pause for a minute and see if that reminds them of anything that they have heard of here in the United States. I would note, too, that as we've noted in past broadcasts, there is a history of operational connections between Danish neo-Nazis and Nazis in Germany. A research credit on the following also goes to Dave White. This is from the Daily Telegraph of Monday, January 20th of 1997. This is an article headlined, Mixed Marriage Sports Star Was Mail Bomb Target. It's by Julian Isherwood in Copenhagen and David Graves. And it, skipping down, we read, Mr. Jensen, he's the investigator involved here. Mr. Jensen added, the indications are that an extreme right-wing group in Denmark is being controlled from abroad with the intention of hitting international targets. And again, one wonders if perhaps that control from abroad comes from Germany. The last item I'm going to discuss in this program comes from a book entitled Unholy Alliance, subtitled A History of Nazi Involvement with the Occult. It's authored by Peter Levenda, L-E-V-E-N-D-A, published in softcover by Avon Books, and copyrighted 1995. And one of the things that's discussed in this book is the fact that the Order, the neo-Nazi group which murdered Alan Berg and performed bank robberies and that apparently served as something of a launching pad for the Cause group, according to Skinner, who, according to Skinner, dispatched Nicole and Ron on as close to the 10th anniversary of the murder of Alan Berg as they could. That's according to Skinner, the Order was financed by, quote, German families, unquote, living in Latin America. And in the book Unholy Alliance, we read, according to one informant who told the story to former Order member Thomas Martinez, the Order was receiving contributions from German, quote, families, unquote, living in South America. This German Nazi, South American Nazi, North American Nazi link is reinforced by stories that German neo-Nazi terrorist Manfred Raeder, R-O-E-D-E-R, for instance, met with Dr. Mengele in Brazil as late as 1978, before coming to the States and meeting with American neo-Nazi groups. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.
Opinions expressed on KFJC are not necessarily those of its staff or management. Responsible parties with opposing views may be given time to air those views. For more information, write to the Public Affairs Director at KFJC, 12345 El Monte Road, Los Altos Hills, California, 94022.
Dave Emery's lifetime of work, both broadcast and in print, is available on a 32-gigabyte flash drive for a tax-deductible contribution of $65 or more. This flash drive contains Dave's programs and lectures, as well as the written descriptions for them. In addition, a library of anti-fascist books on easy-to-download PDF files. The drive also features a series of videotaped lectures on the relationship between fascism and religion, as well as another video lecture about the background of Barack Obama. There is plenty of room on this drive for downloading future programs and articles. To obtain Dave's 35 plus years of work, visit the online store at kfjc.org.
Broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC Los Altos Hills.